Omarosa's tell-all book about her experience in the Trump White House comes out tomorrow, but there have been plenty of lead-up interviews that are making headlines. On Inside Perspective from the political junkie Ken Rudin, is this book important? Also, firefighters further contain California's major wildfires. A weather change over the weekend helped. We'll get an update. Green Valley Theater is staging the Sacramento premiere of the musical The Black Rider. We'll talk with a cast member and the director. And with what would have been Leonard Bernstein's centennial birthday on August 25th. We're going to recue some of my conversation with pianist Laura Downs. She performs his music too. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Omarosa Manigault Newman was a star in President Trump's TV series, The Apprentice, and in the series, he fired her more than once. Omarosa joined the White House staff in January of 2017 as Director of Communications for the Office of Public Liaison, and she was fired from that job 1 year later. Her new memoir, titled Unhinged, comes out tomorrow. She's been releasing excerpts and granting advance interviews, including an intense 10 minutes with Savannah Guthrie this morning on the Today Show. Here is some of the exchange that happened with Savannah when Omarosa wanted to end the interview.
You want to talk about the book, called Unhinged.
You know that we have an interview right after this.
Yes.
And I know that you want to go more with more time. But I will answer your last question, and you see that the time is
Yeah, what time do you need to go?
No, you know that it's a seven-minute interview. Now we're at 10.
Are we? I don't know. I actually don't know the time. But if you want to answer it, if you got to go,
I'm going to say this to you.
All right, that was just one of the awkward, uncomfortable exchanges. There are many questions about what Omarosa is talking about and what she's written about in the book, including the overall question, how important is this book? So let's check in with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hi, Ken.
Beth.
Yeah.
Beth, what is happening to us?
I mean,
this is insane. This is a reality TV presidency, and now we're talking about a reality. I mean, she's the disgruntled guest from The Apprentice who everybody wants to know what she's thinking and how she's reacting. And then they're asking Kellyanne Conway, who has probably never told the truth a day in her life, goes on TV and says, what do you think about Omarosa? She'll say, well, she's a lawyer. I mean, it's just surreal. It's more reality TV.
I really weighed whether to begin this conversation with this, but I decided to do so for a couple reasons. People everywhere are going to hear about her because she did so many interviews and the book comes out tomorrow. She did manage to somehow make a secret recording in the Situation Room where she was fired. That alone begs a little bit of discussion.
Absolutely.
And then she talks about the fact that there are three different tapes or multiple tapes of the president using the N-word during production of The Apprentice. So, yeah, we shouldn't be spending time on this, but oh well, here we are.
No, but you know something, you do make a very important point. The fact is, she recorded a conversation in the Situation Room with John Kelly, the chief of staff, as he's firing her. The thought of recording a conversation in this super secret room, and there's no protection against people recording conversations, but I think it lets you know what life is like in the White House. The fact that Michael Cohen is taping the president and Omarosa is taping John Kelly, if not the president as well. It seems like everybody is either paranoid or just not trusting anyone, and that's what life seems to be. And you know, I didn't see this morning's interview, but I did watch her interviewed by Chuck Todd. And for somebody who just was such a Trump booster for so long, and now suddenly is since she was fired, to be such a Trump critic, it's just head spinning.
Savannah Guthrie asked Omarosa, how she managed to tape this conversation with General Kelly or with the president. And she said, I'll leave that to your imagination. And Savannah said, why be coy? She said, I'm not being coy. But she said that she has protections, that she's not worried about legal consequences because she is a whistleblower. That was her phrase. Here's Omarosa talking about General Kelly.
And the moment I said I would like to leave and they said I can't go, it became false imprisonment. Calm down. And the other part of this is I'm going to tell you that there are other people who have been treated this way by General Kelly. There's a lot of very corrupt things that are happening in the White House, and I am going to blow the whistle on a lot of this.
Are you concerned at all about any legal consequences for taping
they
in a situation room? But
they
are
should
you
be concerned?
Are
no,
you?
Absolutely not, because I have protections. The moment that I've decided to blow the whistle on a lot of the corruption going on in the White House, there are protections that are afforded to me.
So, Ken, she alleges that she was taken into the Situation Room and kept there for 4 hours and that there were four men with her alone talking to her. So she does have something to say about that situation. In this interview, she repeatedly tells Savannah to calm down. I think that it's worth watching and listening to as you decide for yourself whether to listen to this person. And again, I come back to that original question, Ken. Is this book important? Is it a piece of the quilt that's going to be assembled about this presidency?
Well, I think the answer to that is definitely yes. I mean, we saw that with the Fire and Fury book. Fire and Fear, whatever the Michael Wolff book was. I mean, it was only a blip of the time. It didn't last that long, but it did show a lot of the internal workings or unworkings in the White House. But it also comes on a weekend where we hear to see the announcement that Michael Avenatti, the Stormy Daniels attorney, is now talking about running for president.
How about that?
I mean, why not? Maybe, and have Omarosa as a running mate. I mean, there are very few people in the world who only are all known only by their first name, like Omarosa and Cher and Beth. I mean, you know, these are giants in the I'm sorry about that.
Let's just go past that.
It's so remarkable.
Michael Avenatti was in Iowa, and he said he wanted to, quote, listen to people and learn about some issues that are facing the citizens of Iowa and do my homework. Well, that's probably wise advice in many arenas of anyone's life, right?
Well, yes. And you know something? I mean, what does Michael Avenatti know about running for president? What is Donald Trump knowing about running for president? This is all... It all seems to be personality driven. I mean, the thought of somebody like Joe Biden, who was in the Senate for 450 years, running for president, I mean, that just seems, of course, it was 36 years, but it just seems so old-fashioned. Now it's just, I mean, people wanted Oprah Winfrey to run. Michael Avenatti is talking to people in Iowa, and I'm not criticizing them as much as I am just acknowledging that we have a new realm of politics that I just, for somebody who's been covering it for so long, is I'm still dumbstruck. I'm still surprised. And maybe that's the most surprising thing of all, that I'm still surprised by this stuff.
Well, I don't know how much you're going to look at a candidate and right away say, are they running for office to make money? Are they running for office for fame? Are they running for office to be able to write a book? You know, there are a lot of reasons that people get into politics now, and maybe you look at it through a different lens of a different time, Ken.
But you know something? All those questions you just asked are absolutely legitimate. We don't know if candidates are serious. We don't know if they're doing it to sell a book. We don't know if they're trying to get attention. Did anybody think when Donald Trump was musing about running for president in 2013, 2014, 2015, that he would actually run, let alone get the nomination, let alone get elected president? I certainly wasn't among them. So, yes, you're absolutely right. You know, what used to be the norm in politics, that word norm, you know, it only exists on the Cheers TV show. It doesn't exist in real life anymore.
Well, you say TV. I think some of his plan might have been the TV network or the Trump TV show. But a lot of people did listen to him and took that seriously, cheered him on, and then voted for him. So
yep.
Here we have it. Let me shift you a little bit to the ongoing story of the Manafort trial. Prosecutors say they're going to call a witness or two or three today, but they do expect to rest their case. And I know you're following the case closely. The entire case could be wrapped up pretty soon.
Maybe. I mean, you're absolutely right. The prosecution does look like it's going to close out its case, and then we still have to hear from the defense. I mean, everything I hear, look, it seems clear that everything that Manafort is accused, Paul Manafort is accused of doing occurred prior to him working for the president for the Trump campaign, which seems to be only from March till August of 2016. I think the reason Robert Mueller has such an interest in him is that he was there. First of all, he was there during that meeting at Trump Tower when Manafort and Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner all met with that Russian woman who had ties to the Kremlin, who was offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. So Manafort may know stuff, but for all the salaciousness we're hearing about him, about his expensive suits and the fact that he was in debt and the fact that he lied to so many people and the fact that his aide, Rick Gates, stole from him and lied to him as well, and the fact that Manafort himself had extramarital affairs and the fact that he lied to banks to get bank loans and the fact that he's on trial for, you know, tax evasion and bank fraud. It doesn't feel like it has anything to do with Trump, but I guess maybe Mueller's trying to put the screws on Manafort to basically say, well, look, if you come clean on this stuff, we'll give you a break if you tell us what you know about Mueller. So the Trump people are saying that it's a witch hunt, that there's nothing there. But I suspect that everything I've seen about Manafort shows that there is a there. I don't know what the connection is with Trump, but it seems like Manafort is not going to wind up in a good position should this go to a jury.
I should go back and count how many times you just said the word lying, because I hate to think that lying is more of a participation sport in this country than it ever has been. But in terms of politics, we know it's always been present. I just don't know to what degree it's different in this administration.
I think that's true. And, you know, sometimes I get impatient, and maybe it's more about me. Sometimes I'll look at newspaper headlines and I'll say, well, look at all these untruths or look at all these falsehoods. I think you need to say it like it is. And if they're not telling the truth, if you're making stuff up, which we see day in and day out in this administration, it's a lie. And sometimes, you know, that's one of the problems about the risks of the president testifying before Robert Mueller, because the president believes in so much of what he says. He may insist he's not lying and he may believe that he's not lying, but when you look at, you know, what the facts are, it's falsehood.
Well, the irony, though, Ken, is that you listen to Trump supporters across the country, and what are they often quoted or heard saying? And it is, we love this president because he tells it like
it is.
Yeah.
Right. And we don't care because of alleged lies, because Obama lied and Hillary Clinton lied and William Henry Harrison lied. So I kind of think that, Look, Trump does have an appeal to a large segment of this country. It may not be a majority, but it's certainly a large segment of this country that they're just tired of the way things have been all along, and they're willing to forgive or overlook or ignore some of these worst bad transgressions. But there are others who say, look, if there was involvement from a foreign power to influence this country, and if, there's a big if, but if people in the Trump campaign worked with Russia to make this happen, I don't know how you turn your side and shrug your shoulders and say it's politics as usual. So you know something, ultimately Robert Mueller could have his investigation and release everything to the American public, and you still may have 40% of the American people saying, so what, or we don't care. A lot has to do with what happens on November 6th in the midterm elections and in the year 2020, but ultimately something being stated by a prosecutor saying, this is what the facts are, that may not be enough.
All right. Well, we should be talking about House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes, who, of course, is from California. But we're just going to post a couple links about that because our time is kind of short. Maybe one mention here, Ken, of primary elections, which continue across the country. And there is a recount happening in Kansas.
There's a recount of Kansas with Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State, challenging the incumbent governor there. That right now is only a lead of 110 votes. There's likely to be a recounting of provisional votes in that special election in Ohio between Danny O'Connor, the Democrat, and Troy Balderson, the Republican, in a seat that has always gone Republican. So these are two very close contests. And if nothing else, and it gives you the old, it returns you to the old adage, every vote counts, and you've just got to vote because every single vote makes a difference.
All right, Ken, thanks so much. We will not be talking to you next week, but we'll catch you the week after, okay?
Yes, but please post on your page my phone, home phone number, and everybody can call me at home so we can have our regular Monday chat.
Well, you know, everybody wants to talk to you, so okay, you'll be happy to. How about I post a link to your website instead?
That's probably safer.
All right, Ken, thanks so much.
Thank you,
Matt. But I'll call you later anyway. All right, that is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find more at capradio.org/insight, including that link to his website. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio, your NPR station. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. You might already know that Yosemite Valley will reopen tomorrow. The Ferguson fire is getting closer to being fully contained, and the air in the valley has cleared significantly. We'll have a conversation about that in a moment. Meanwhile, on the phone with us is Chief Mike Moeller from CAL FIRE. He is the Deputy Director of Communications. And Chief, this was an important weekend at the major wildfire sites, wasn't it?
Absolutely, Beth. I mean, just amazing progress. Even with our fire weather watches and red flag warnings, firefighters were able to make amazing progress. Still a lot of line to build and contain these fires, but definitely an improvement.
There was some change in the weather, and this week we're hearing that instead of upper 90s, we're going to have mid or lower 90s. Do those small changes in degree matter significantly out there?
They absolutely do. And it's more so the overnight temperatures. I mean, yes, we'll still see those temperatures hovering in the 90s. But it's the overnight recovery that we really look at as far as the increase in our humidity levels that can help the fire actually lay down at night. But again, weather plays a major, major role, as you well know. So any type of degree change, humidity increase, and the lack of wind is an improvement for firefighters.
Could you give me a status report on this huge Mendocino complex fire on both parts of it?
Absolutely. So right now what we're looking at is the complete fire itself is 344,890 acres. The river fire, 48,920 acres. And the ranch is 295,970 acres. And we're looking at an overall containment of 68% on both of those fires right now.
So is that fire moving in a direction that will produce increased threat, or I guess geographically, what's happening with it?
Right now, it's running into a pretty open area. Again, anyone in those areas is always asked to, you know, stay with that situational awareness that we talk about. But it's moving into a uninhabited area. Still a lot of very difficult terrain. But at this point, no. But anytime we have a threat of open fire line, communities anywhere in and around that area should be, in that situational awareness mode.
All right, and let's move to the CAR FIRE in the Redding area. And the warnings came out over the weekend to people going back into the burned areas as well.
Yeah, that's correct. So the CAR FIRE right now, 202,976 acres, 61% containment. We are happy to report we were able to lift evacuations in most of those areas. Unfortunately, some of the fire survivors are returning to, structures that have been completely destroyed. And I can tell you, as the incident and first responders, our thoughts and prayers are with all of those families. But we always have to issue a warning when people enter those areas, because the infrastructure may be restored to a certain extent, but there's still all sorts of hazards, especially going through your property and areas that are burned. So again, extreme caution if you are from those areas.
What's happening with the movement of resources right now, Chief? Because there have been smaller fires that have erupted, sometimes growing maybe up close to 1,000 acres. There was a big grass fire on the hillside near Fairfield that was visual and quite frightening. Are you able to move people around a little more now?
No, absolutely, Beth, and that's a great question. We need resources really on an hourly basis, not only CAL FIRE, our local government partners through the cooperation of the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, our federal partners are moving resources depending on the fire activity. But when we have what we call an initial attack fire, that's meaning somebody calling 911 to report a vegetation fire, we'll actually divert resources from one of the major fires to hit that hard because we don't want those smaller fires to turn into these large conflagrations. So, again, very orchestrated. There's a lot of tactics and strategy that go into moving resources.
Well, since we're talking about resources, let me ask you about available water. And I'm speaking to the tweet that came from the president and the discussion of the water supply available to CAL FIRE. So I can't talk to you and not ask you about it.
No, what I can say is water has not been an impact to any of our operations, firefighting operations statewide, including the Northern California large fires. We work, with not only what we call our domestic water supply, which for your listeners would be where your fire engine actually pulls up and hooks into a fire hydrant and has water, but also using large bodies of water. If you look at the Mendocino complex, we had several large bodies of water where our aircraft can actually use and dip into. But no, absolutely no issue with water. I think the main fact is what we're seeing and what we should be focused on is these fires, unfortunately, are becoming, larger and larger because of what we're seeing is fuel conditions and climate, adaptation to these fuels. And that's why we're seeing these large devastating fires with high temperatures, winds, low humidities.
One more question, Chief. I understand that somewhere around 800,000 acres now have burned in the state in these most recent fires. Do you know how that compares to where we were at this time last year?
You know what? I don't. I don't have the stats that come out this every Monday, usually midday. But I can tell you we're at actually 726,000 acres.
Okay.
We have the state's largest fire on history right now. So I can tell you we are well ahead of it, and we are only in August. And unfortunately, again, you and I have talked. If this is a precursor, we could see to the rest of the year. Unfortunately, first responders are going to be very busy, and we rely on the public to please stay aware, visit readyforwildfire.org, have that evacuation plan, and just prepare.
All right. It's always a pleasure to have some of your time. Thanks a lot, Chief.
Thank you so much.
And continued safety to everybody out on the line. That is CAL FIRE's Deputy Director of Communications, Mike Mueller. On the phone with us now from Yosemite is Scott Gettyman. Ranger Gettyman, some good news about the park reopening tomorrow, but tell me the bigger picture. What is the situation with the Ferguson Fire and Yosemite Valley?
Well, good morning. Yeah, we do have some great news. Yeah, the Ferguson fire, as of this morning, is 83% contained. The incident management teams that have been working with us on suppressing the fire have done a wonderful job. Today, we are getting the Mariposa Grove open. Tomorrow, Yosemite Valley reopens to visitors. All of the evacuations have been lifted, and the only closure that remains is Highway 41 or the Wawona Road, which is the road inside of Yosemite from Wawona to Yosemite Valley. On that Highway 41 corridor, there is still active fire going, and so that road will be closed for about another week.
Will you tell me about the air quality, which was the major concern in the valley, and describe visually how the valley is today?
Well, the air quality, as people know, has certainly been a concern and was reaching unhelpful air levels. The air quality has been steadily improving over the past 4 or 5 days and, of course, is variable throughout the day. I'm here in Yosemite Valley, and looking out my window, it's blue skies. There's certainly some haze in the air and some smoke in the air, but it's pretty clear right now. Generally, it's clearest in the morning and then gets kind of socked in the afternoon and the evening. But as I mentioned, the last few days have been much better. So visitors coming back to Yosemite Valley tomorrow, for example, should expect certainly some better air, but all of the smoke is certainly not gone yet.
How has the park handled the many, many cancellations over the last 2 weeks or so? And did any of those cancellations or plans roll forward in any way?
Well, there's a few different factors here at play. For us with the National Park Service, for example, the only overnight accommodations that we run are the campgrounds. And so people that had campground reservations were canceled, unfortunately, and those people got refunded. Since our reservation campsites sell out 5 months ahead of time, we weren't able to rebook those people. And so, for example, if anyone has a campsite reservation tomorrow night, we'll be able to utilize that. Yosemite Hospitality, the company that runs our lodging, was also providing refunds, and they're going to reopen, of course, all of the lodging here in Yosemite Valley tomorrow evening, and so that's a great thing. And there's also been some cancellations later on this week or next week, so there is an opportunity for some people to get rooms or cabins later this week or next week, but they have provided refunds and have been able to rebook people to the best of what the supply will allow.
Clearly, Scott, this was a decision about safety for everybody involved. But can you also gauge the impact, the tourism impact, or the impact otherwise in terms of the closure of the park?
The impact due to the Ferguson fire is huge and far-reaching from a visitor standpoint. Of course, this is the busiest part of the summer and the busy season, so we've had a lot of visitors both from here in the United States and also internationally who either had to postpone their trips or cut their trips short. So it's been a huge impact for the thousands of people, literally thousands of people per day that would come into Yosemite National Park. It's also been a huge economic impact for us here at Yosemite. For example, the entrance fee money, 80% of which stays in the park. We've lost thousands of dollars in that revenue. Our in-park concessioner has lost a lot of money, and so have the gateway communities. Communities like Oakhurst, Mariposa, Sonora that are surrounding the park are mostly, if not fully, dependent on tourism to the park, and so it's always a hit when the park is closed, but given the fact that the park is closed during literally the peak of the summer season and also for an extended period of time, created huge impacts, and these communities collectively have lost literally millions of dollars. But now that we're reopening, we're going to do the best we can to let folks know that the park is reopened, and we want to welcome visitors back to Yosemite.
In light of what you just said, has it set into motion any conversation about a surcharge, an increase in fees, anything in the future to help recoup some of that loss?
Well, it's interesting because the fees are set by Washington, and we collect the fees. And so with 80% of that money staying in the park, it helps us do things, everything from trail maintenance to fixing up roads, campgrounds, things like that. So we don't have any plans or considerations for any extra fee. You know, once we get the valley open tomorrow, we'll have a lot of people here. And it's just one of those things where we just don't feel that, you know, it's certainly fair to charge anybody more money for coming in. And we've certainly lost money, some of the revenue, but we have a lot of visitors and we're expecting everybody will be back. And it's mid-August, so we've still got another few weeks of the busy visitor season. And we're really busy here in Yosemite, you know, through mid-October into November. So, we're feeling good about where we are.
Well, it's great news to hear that you feel safe, and with the fire at 83% containment, that everyone is advising you that it is okay to reopen to the public. I thank you so much for your time over the last 2 weeks so that we were able to check in with you directly. I know it's no small thing to carve out time for these conversations. So again, Ranger Gediman, appreciation.
You're very welcome, and it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That is Scott Gediman from Yosemite Valley, and you can find out more details about the reopening tomorrow and the continued rollout reopening in the Yosemite Valley at capradio.org. You're listening to Cap Radio on NPR.
Come on along with us.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. If you don't recognize that music, don't worry. We're going to tell you all about it. It's from a classic German fairy tale turned into the musical The Black Rider. It's being staged by Green Valley Theater. And the show opened last weekend. The book is by William S. Burroughs, music and lyrics by Tom Waits. This is the Sacramento premiere of this musical in the studio with me. The all-in-one director, scene designer, and costume designer, Christopher Cook. You probably wear even more hats than that, Chris.
Hello there, Beth. Yeah, totally.
Glad to have you here. Also, the actor who plays Pegleg, that is Victoria Timoteo.
Hi,
Hi, Victoria. A lot to say about your character. So let's talk about this musical. It is new to some audiences here. And this is the classic young man makes a deal with the devil, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, it's a weird story. It's old, you know, it's old, it's old, it's German, it's funky, and yeah, it's been a lot to put together.
Der Freischütz?
Der Freischütz, yes. That's the, in German, the free shooter. Basically the idea that making a deal with the devil for some bullets that will hit anything that the hunter wants. However, the deal being that one bullet out of them will hit anything that the devil wants.
So our producers walked into the newsroom and said, Satan's here this morning.
Hello.
Do you want to take it from there, Victoria?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, being the devil is awesome. From Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale, the devil is seen as a soldier with a peg leg and also as like an old hag and things like that. And in German folklore, the devil's seen as many different things. So it's cool that I get to play like a few different characters as well as the devil. So, yeah, I don't know. It's challenging, but I get to be very physical and very scary.
I haven't seen the show. Are you supposed to be gender specific as the devil?
Not really. We refer to the devil as he and him, but it's kind of just more so playing a character in general. So it's not very gender specific, I think. The devil's more of like a creature than a person.
Can I hear some of the voice?
Yeah,
could
definitely.
Could you do a little bit for me?
Yeah, I have like a little teeny monologue.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Do you want to
get
like
I'll
the
tell
setting?
Everybody, this is again Victoria Timoteo, and this is the Sacramento premiere of The Black Rider being staged by Green Valley Theater.
Yeah.
So in this scene, Wilhelm has gone into the forest and is basically realizing that he can't shoot at all. And so, therefore, cannot prove himself to the hunter's family.
He's kind of a bookish guy, right?
Totally. Mm-hmm. He's the city slicker. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's very bumbling and played by an amazing Kyle Welling, who's just totally killing it on stage. But he's not killing anything in the forest. And so he basically is approached by the devil. And
because, can we just say a little bit more here? He's in love with a woman. And she's not going to be allowed to marry him because he can't shoot?
Yes. Basically, it's a hunter's family. They live in the forest. There's a mom, dad, daughter. And daughter has fallen in love with the city guy. And the father absolutely will not let them marry because of the fact that the city guy cannot provide for the family, so to speak, in that way, in a way that he can relate to.
So we have a problem. Mm-hmm. Perfect entree for the devil.
Yeah. So... Well, laddie buck, you seem to be down on your luck, but don't worry, it's fine. I'll lend you some marbles of mine. It's easy fixed. Question of how the bullet is mixed. You're lucky you came to me and not some bloody quack. As an old soldier, I've got the knack. Here are some bullets, very sure. You've got the trouble, I've got the cure. That's it.
Oh, you're pretty wicked.
Thank you, yeah. I'm a little bit louder on stage, but...
does a parental warning go along with the show, Chris?
Only partially. Mm-hmm. There are, to be completely very careful about stuff, we're always very careful in our parental warnings at Green Valley, things like there's a couple of four-letter words,
okay.
But there's nothing sexy, and however, there's a lot of little cute little stuffed animals that get shot.
Oh, oh, no.
And so there's a lot of dead animals running around.
Not the stuffies.
Exactly. So there's a lot of very cute little animals.
Well, you can't have a show like this without some shooting somewhere along the way. Yeah. How about the Tom Waits music?
The Tom Waits music is gorgeous. And that's actually what drew us to the show in the first place. Unfortunately, what's out there to listen to is very sparse. There's a really cool album that he made as a concept album for the show. And then there's some other recordings of other groups. But there's not much. And so we ended up having to go through an entire process of reorchestrating the music and kind of discovering the beauty that he composed into it. It's just amazing.
Wow. Well, for a sample, here is a bit of Black Rider. I think it's a song titled November. Let's listen. Production that was staged in Norway. That is a piece of the music composed by Tom Waits. So how much license did you feel like you had in directing this, Christopher, for Green Valley Theater to take it on in a region where it hasn't been staged before? Seems wide open to make some changes or improvise.
Completely. The original was done by Robert Wilson, and it was done in a very, very specific avant-garde German style, which makes it it means you have a contentious relationship with it, because you don't want to just simply, you can't approach a work and say, hey, let's go ahead and take his direction, because that's not our show, and it'd be disingenuous to do so. So it means we had to completely start from scratch on this, because it has been staged quite a bit in Europe, but not so much in the U.S. In Berkeley, it's been around the country a bit, but it's not done so much on this side of the pond. And so we basically completely started from scratch on this. We took that avant-garde style and we decided to take what is a very American approach to it. So we took vaudeville. So we have a vaudeville kind of idea to the slapstick comedy. Everything is very physical. And at the same time, we also decided to take an imagined – we basically took from the beginning. We thought, what if we had this imaginary theater company? The Kolber Kinderspiel, the most excellent und strenuous Kolber Kinderspiel. And they are this ragtag group, and they're in this Bavarian forest pub, and they're trying to put on this show, and they're just really trying their hardest, and it might not be turning out so well for them. And so that's how we imagined it. Same thing with the music. Can you sit there? Do I ask them to do their own Tom Waits impression? Well, that's weird and that's odd and it's disingenuous again. So it meant that we had to find what it is about each performer and what they bring to each one of the roles.
That's Christopher Cook. He is director, scene designer, and costume designer. Also in the studio with me is Victoria Timoteo, who is in the role of Peg Leg / the devil / the evil, fun, wicked character to watch. Tell me about your costuming.
Costuming? So we did Shock-Headed Peter a couple years ago.
Right.
And there's a jacket that I wore in Shock-Headed Peter that we were like, we got to wear it again, because it's got a lot of good juju in that, just from that show, because it was very similar to this. It was like German folklore and things like that. I'm in all black, and I have one regular shoe, and then I have one high-heeled boot, and it's glittery, so you can see it. So that's the peg leg that we utilize in that. So I use that a lot with my physicality and just utilizing the sound of that stepping.
Are you liking this niche of avant-garde? Unusual, weird, as you say, Chris. Understatement, weird plays.
Well, I figure you can always put on a show. Any theater company, we can always put on a show. We can put on things that people have, and there is a lot of satisfaction to putting on things that you've seen before, or things that you connect with because you saw a movie of it or that sort of thing. But I think there's also a place, and I think there's a place for. And I also think the Sacramento community is really hungry for new and odd and weird and experimental. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of success with a lot of great companies around town that are doing that kind of stuff. And we like to find the weird ones.
Did you know this musical, Victoria?
I actually didn't before this. No, yeah. It was a really fun surprise.
So it is, again, The Black Rider. It's being staged at Westminster Presbyterian Church Hall, which is at 1300 N Street in Sacramento. It opened August 3rd. It continues through the 25th, and shows are Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 7. What kind of audience reaction are you getting?
We're having, like, a really good turnout. It's so much fun. Like, it's fun to hear the audience react to things that we didn't expect. You know, we're like, oh, that is funny. Or like, oh, that is weird and like hard to grasp. But it's really cool. And I feel like everyone's there like for a really great experience. So,
do you have one of those moments for your own character where there was a reaction you didn't expect, or a moment or a laugh?
I think just for like the opening part, just because we utilize the space in a really cool way. There's like a really cool catwalk, and I'm not going to give anything away, but we do something fun with that in the opening. So it's fun to see everyone not expect, you know, the action to come from there. So I like seeing that.
I do want to let people know, in terms of tickets, we're going to post a link to Green Valley Theater, which is spelled theatre.com/tickets. But you can also buy tickets right at the church hall, mm-hmm. right before the show, correct?
Okay. Free parking, by the way.
Free parking is always nice. Yes. Green Valley is now in, what are you at, 13 years as a theater company in Sacramento? I think that would be right if you were founded in 2005. So are you already looking ahead to next season?
Absolutely. We're looking ahead to next season. We're going to be expanding from our main stage. We basically do anywhere from four to five main stage musicals. One, of course, is The Rocky Horror Show, which we are doing our 10th anniversary production this year over at the 24th Street Theater. But we're going to be expanding and starting to do a couple of straight plays in our season. Those are plays that are non-musical plays. And so we're going to be expanding into some of those.
Somebody just had a light bulb moment and said, oh, they're the theater company that does Rocky Horror Picture Show. They're the ones. So since we mentioned it, do you know the dates of that
one? Yes, we do. We do the Rocky Horror Show. We do it live. It's not the Shadowcast. There's a lot of great groups that do that in town. We do a full production, and that's going to be opening on October 19th, and it's going to run until November 3rd. And we have some odd dates in there. This year, a little change. We're doing all 8 p.m. performances as opposed to midnights, which was more traditional in the past. But
okay.
So changing it up this year.
And Victoria, you're in that cast too, aren't you?
Yes. I was actually cast as Riff Raff.
So
that'll be fun.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you. It's always great to have you here. And Shockheaded Peter was so popular with people. I know you had a lot of sellouts, so I can imagine this one is a great riot too.
Mm-hmm. Such fun.
All right.
That show was kind of like our big, like, we just had so much fun. We're like, can we just do that every year? No, hold it off. No,
yeah,
don't
there was
again.
Probably a moment of, wow, we can do this. We did this too. Well, good. Well, good luck with The Black Rider. And again, we'll post the link for everybody. That is Christopher Cook and Victoria Timoteo. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you,
Continued
Beth.
Success at Green Valley Theater. Again, the show is at Westminster Church, the Presbyterian Church in Sacramento. That link will be at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.
No shadows, no stars. There's no moon and no cars. November.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. The great American composer and conductor Leonard Bernstein died in 1990. But later this month, on August 25th, he would have been celebrating his 100th birthday. So there are continuing tributes to his legacy, including an album released earlier this year by the Sacramento-based classical pianist Laura Downs. The album is titled For Lenny. Laura has been touring with the music, and she visited us in February, so we're going to recue some of the conversation. Laura will be talking about the song Big Stuff, which Bernstein wrote for Billie Holiday in 1946, and you'll hear Laura perform, too.
He wrote this as the opening number of his ballet Fancy Free. And the funny thing is that when he, at the time, he was, you know, a young guy. And it was, I guess, his, you know, his first big show. But he was not moving in the same circles as Billie Holiday, who was already a superstar. So he wrote this with her in mind. He admired her so much as a musician. But he didn't have the, you know, the chutzpah or the means, I guess, to get in touch with her directly. So his sister Shirley sang this in the first performances of the show. Then, you know, the song did get into her hands and she fell in love with it and recorded it, I think, 6 times. Mm. But for me, you know, because you know the relationship that I have with Billie Holiday and how much she has meant to me as a musician, and now Bernstein too, and just this kind of brings them, you know, both into the same room over my shoulder, and it just, it feels like everything is coming together.
So beautiful. That's Laura Downs. She's in our studio at the keyboard sharing music from her new album, For Lenny, The Anniversaries. All these groups of special songs that he composed for special, important people in his life. Have the anniversaries been a part of your repertoire, your playing for many, many years since your training, I guess, in Europe?
No, I came to them a bit later, and I just, you know, when I discovered them, I was really fascinated, you know, to learn everything I could learn through them. You know, they offer really interesting insights into his relationships. For example, you know, there's an anniversary he wrote for Aaron Copland, who is his dear friend and collaborator, and it's almost like a portrait of Copland, and that reaches out in all different directions. And so you kind of just experience all these different relationships through music.
Is any one your favorite?
Depends on the moment. They're also beautiful, and they show such different sides. So I don't know that I have a favorite. I love the anniversary for Stephen Sondheim. It's so beautiful and lyrical, and I think, you know, it's just this very affectionate tribute to the kind of lyricism that he was able to find as a composer when he was working with Sondheim.
Thank you.
Laura, let's finish with a bit about one other track on the album, a song called Some Other Time, which seems appropriate for the ending of a conversation.
Mm-hmm. And the ending of an album, you know, and it's the final track on the album. And I think it's a really beautiful way to put this project to bed. This is one of my favorite songs that Bernstein wrote or that anybody has ever written. It's just a gorgeous, you know, nostalgic tune. It's from the show On the Town.
Laura Downs performing music by Leonard Bernstein in our studio in February when she released her new tribute album titled For Lenny. You can hear the full interview and more music by Laura at capradio.org/insight. Next week, Cap Radio's music station will mark the Bernstein centennial with the airing of many of his compositions and recordings. There is a daily essay by Cap Radio's Stephen Pythman, and it all culminates on Saturday at 4 p.m. with an hour-long special hosted by Stephen. So check our website for more details. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.